Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we speak with Sheel Tile, who is the founder and solo general partner of venture capital firm Amplo, based out of Texas, who invests in mission-driven entrepreneurs that try to solve big global problems. Sheel, thanks for joining us today. And I'm excited to have you on because I have a lot of questions. You're one of those amazing young people that has accomplished so much at such a young age. And I've been lucky enough to know your brother as well. And so you guys are kind of models for my kids. And so I'm excited to have you on. To kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about your fund and the strategy?
It's been a pleasure knowing you, both personally and professionally. I started Amplo, which is the name of my venture capital firm, in 2017. And I had been in the venture business for a while before that at two big firms, Bessemer and NEA, before starting my own. And really the thesis behind Amplo is that the biggest companies in the world are created by entrepreneurs not motivated by money. In fact, if you're motivated by money, my belief is you don't make any. But if you're motivated by solving a big problem, a real problem, that's how you ultimately say no to acquisition offers. That's how you hire people in often a tough job market. It's how you pay people when those employees can probably get much higher salaries elsewhere. And it's how you get through all the hard times that come with building a startup. And so that's the thesis of Amplo. We're not sector focused. We're not stage focused. We are mission focused. And our first fund we launched in 2017, our goal is to invest early. So seed, Series A, Series B, and then follow on aggressively in our best companies. Because our belief is once we know a company and once we have conviction that the company could be a very large business, then we should be doubling down, tripling down, and quadrupling down.
I know that you raised this as a solo GP, which is so rare. And I remember back when I moved from principal to partner in this business and we're raising a first fund as a partner, it was impossible to raise a fund unless you had like three funds under your belt and you had a team of at least three people and so on and so forth. But you've been able to raise now two funds as a solo GP. Can you talk about that? Like what motivated you to start solo and was that hard? How did you accomplish it?
It's a great question. I decided to start solo GP largely because throughout my venture experience, what I found is that the folks who tended to add the most value to our entrepreneurs were two types. One, very senior business leaders who could open doors that were unique. And then the second were political leaders who could help on the regulatory front. And those business leaders were both entrepreneurs as well as Fortune 500 executives. And so when I was launching Amplo, my goal was actually not to hire a bunch of investing professionals or investing partners. It was more, how do I optimize for folks who are going to add value to our entrepreneurs? When I was fundraising, I quickly learned that some people don't like the idea of a solo GP, and some people love the idea of a solo GP. I would say more people did not like the idea than did the idea. So, you know, my first fundraising process, I should say, took a lot more repetitions than I probably would have had I come out with a traditional two or three GP structure. But I do think a lot of people ended up really loving the solo GP model. I think folks thought there was accountability. Often in partnerships, when you have multiple people running the firm, you have no accountability. And in this case, because there's one guy, me, running the firm, if I screw up, they know exactly who to point to. And they appreciate that. Many of my LPs are Fortune 500 CEOs, and they like the fact that there is somebody who is more of a CEO, if you will, of the fund as opposed to a partner. I think there were folks that really liked it. There were institutions that didn't. There were some institutions that really didn't like, quote unquote, the key man risk, where if something happens to me, then what happens to the fund? I actually believe that key man risk is overrated. Because often in other funds, if something happens to one of the GPs, that GP may be the one that you really like. But if something happens to that GP, you're still left with the fund, but run by the GPs you don't like now. Whereas in my case, if something were to happen to me, the fund actually suspends and no new investments are made. So I actually think that's more LP friendly than the converse, but once again, everybody has their own opinion.
True. And when you talk about driving value to your portfolio companies and everything with the business leaders that you partner with, what does that look like? And can you give some examples of that?
Is awesome. It's ex-entrepreneurs, it's political leaders, you name it. And the way we try and add value is to tell our entrepreneurs, we're not going to build the company for you. In fact, you shouldn't want us to. But what we will do is we will be that advisor or that board member who will be able to help you see around corners, whether it's on the regulatory front or whether it's with market dynamics and understanding of where the world is going. Our group, in my opinion, is uniquely suited to help some of these entrepreneurs navigate whatever challenge they may have. And that sort of played out, actually, frankly, better than I expected. When I started Amplo, I really didn't know how our group would be received by entrepreneurs. But now I found it has often been the primary reason we're getting into deals. We're getting into deals far more because of our group of characters that are associated with the firm than we are because of my prior track record. And so let's see if that continues, but so far it's been positive.
So you've been operating out of Houston and you have a focus on global businesses. How do you make that work given that there's a lot of sentiment in the market that you have to be local, especially when you're investing early?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my venture career was mostly on the coasts. When I was at Bessemer, I was in New York. And when I was at NEA, I was in Menlo Park in the Bay Area. When I started Amplo, one of the things I realized was one of the best things about starting your own firm is you can live where you want. And my parents were in Houston. I grew up much of my childhood in Houston, and it's a place I consider home. And I was like, why not just base this in Houston? We live in a world where as long as you're able to jump on a plane, and that was pre-COVID, and now it's as long as you're willing to jump on a Zoom, you can basically do this job from anywhere. And as I integrated into the Houston culture and society and business sort of groups, I realized that it was a very warm and welcoming environment where what we did, venture capital and specifically technology venture capital, was actually far more unique in a place like Houston or Texas at that time than it is on the coasts. And as a result, I was able to just meet a lot of interesting people that have actually ended up helping a lot of our businesses. Our portfolio is global. My goal is to build one of the world's best venture capital firms. It's not to build one of the world's best venture capital firms in Texas. And as a result, our companies are global. We have, I would guess, a third of our companies outside the US. And in the US, our companies are all over. We have California and New York, some Texas, really everywhere. And I envision that continuing.
That's great. And so when you talk about the mission of Amplo, which is to support entrepreneurs that are building global companies that are solving real world problems, is that approach thesis driven, especially around what problems those are? And if so, if you can expand on that, that'd be great.
Sometimes we have theses on where the world is going. Other times we are opportunistic. And in the latter's case, Robinhood is a great example. I did not have a stock brokerage thesis or how the world was moving and how the brokerage industry worked prior to actually meeting with the Robinhood guys. And it was understanding what they were doing and why they were doing it, and then quickly getting up to speed on the market and the opportunity that led us to invest in that business. The flip side is we often do have theses around, say, workforce training or mental health, and we'll actively go and try and find a company in that space after having done a bunch of homework on where we think the market is going, what type of new solution is going to emerge, is there a regulatory push or pull that may cause a certain type of solution to win that may not have worked previously. And then we'll go run around either the country or the world, depending on the geography we're looking at, to find that opportunity. So we do a mix of both.
Are there any theses that you have developed considering the current situation with COVID, particularly when you're thinking about if there are going to be implications within the next 3 to 5 years, whether that's socially or psychologically from a business standpoint?
We think COVID is going to be around longer than people think. If we think the vaccine is going to take longer, we think even once the vaccine comes, distribution is going to take longer. And it's going to reemerge all around the world because you will have people who don't get the vaccine and then get reinfected, either with this strain or a different strain. And so we think that remote work is here to stay and will likely continue. And then there are a number of companies that are being built around that. We think the byproduct of not being able to see humans, interact with humans, is going to cause mental health issues. And it already is causing mental health issues. And so we are really looking at different solutions that promote and better remote therapy. We think that this will exacerbate inequality. And fortunately, it already has. The rich have actually gotten way richer during this pandemic, whereas those who aren't as well off haven't. And we think as a result, that may not necessarily be a business opportunity per se, but it is a social responsibility that eventually transcends business and will impact business. And so we have thoughts, they're constantly evolving as we learn more about the nature of the virus and the nature of borders, right? Borders in some sense have become more fluid than ever before because now you're just a Zoom call away. And they've also become more stringent than ever before because now we can't even go physically into most countries. So we're trying to figure out what exactly that means for us and for investing. But we're excited to see how the world plays out because we are generally optimistic on the future of the world. Nobody's ever won by betting against America, right, or by betting against the world. We think optimism is important because if you're not, then you can just lead yourself down a cycle that's not productive.
No, 100%. Yeah, I totally agree with that.
In fact, I was going to ask about that because you kind of have a unique position that you're not based at one of the epicenters of venture in the US. How do you feel about venture in general these days and, you know, early stage in particular?
The market right now in the early stage seems totally nuts, especially on the coasts. And there's a huge disparity actually that I'm seeing right now between, say, seed series A deals on the coast, especially on the West Coast, versus the rest of the world. And just as an example, or there are multiple companies that are spinning out of, call it unicorns or about to be unicorns or companies that just went public. And these founders, they haven't really done anything except work at these companies. And they're launching new companies. And pre-launch, they are getting $5 to $6 million on $20 to $30 million valuations. And it's a phenomenon I haven't seen before. It used to be to get that type of valuation pre-launch, you had to have founded a $1 billion company before, not having worked at a $1 billion company. And the market is crazy. And I think that's a result of the stock market being at an all-time high and technology businesses trading at crazy multiples, which trickles down. First it trickled down to the late stage, and now it's trickling down in the early stage. I also think there's a ton of capital out there that is just being deployed in the ecosystem. And I think, Thanasis, you and I have talked about this. Low interest rates. America is still the place people want to invest globally. And so you combine all of these things together, it essentially leads you into equities. And people want to invest in technology because they don't really trust anything else, especially in a pandemic. People think the general trend is technology up, everything else down. So nobody wants to do real estate. Nobody wants to do anything. And so the asset values of all these technology businesses, whether it's early stage or late stage, are benefiting from that. Maybe too much so. What do you think?
I definitely see what you're saying. And I think there is like an overheating of the market. I don't see it as much because we invest more on later stage. But it's interesting because some of the evidence that you're describing reminds me back to the dot-com era of 99. That's not a good thing. At the same time, I see, though, that companies these days get to revenue faster and they have a different scale. Most companies are real companies, but I can definitely see an overheating of the market.
I was very young then, so I wasn't exactly investing. But from having studied it, it seems like the difference between the dot-com bubble and now is often the businesses that were going out in 99, 2000, et cetera, they were not Zoom quality. They were not Datadog, CrowdStrike, Snowflake quality. These businesses today have 120%+ net revenue retention, 70-80% gross margins. They're like very strong businesses, many of them profitable or could be. The issue is they're just trading at crazy forward multiples because everybody wants them, so they're bidding them up.
Right.
Whereas I feel like in 99, 2000, there were just poor businesses. They just were not good businesses.
Well, there are no businesses. I often tell the story of interviewed for a CFO job, and I came from a company with real earnings and public company, et cetera. And the CEO said, hey, we should go public this year. And I said, oh, really? What are your revenues? He goes, we should be able to get to $1 million this year. That was like 99.
Yeah, it's a joke. And by the way, it's not like every business that has gone out, even in today's market, is Zoom. There's been a lot of trash that also happens to find its way into the public markets. But I do think the public markets are recognizing that pretty quickly. And look at a company like Uber. Uber does not have, by any means, unit economics or profitability or gross margin, or you pick the metric, as these high growth software businesses. And as a result, the public markets haven't really rewarded it. The only one that doesn't make sense to me is Tesla, that the public markets have rewarded. And to me, doesn't seem like the quality of a business of many of the other software businesses, but
There seems to be a trend, especially, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, of investing in businesses that kind of conform to a certain value set. Tesla is a good example of that. Beyond Meat might be a good example where young people say, hey, I want to buy this stock because it's electric cars, it's better for the environment, it's this and that. And do you think that's a trend that is out there?
It could be, yeah. I feel like people do want to own what they use, and they are users of or consumers of. Therefore, I do think some of these more consumer type companies will benefit from that. At the end of the day, I think that's retail investing though. And I think retail investors are still, they may drive a lot of beta right now, but I don't think long-term they're going to be the big underlying shareholders of many of these businesses.
So you talked a little bit about one of your companies, Robinhood. I'd be interested in understanding either about that one or if you want to use a different example. What did you see? What did you like in the founders and why did you invest and why did you think it was such a big idea? So whatever you want to use is great.
Yeah, we can use Robinhood just because a lot of people know about that business. So I met the two founders, Vlad and Beju, when they were raising their seed round. They were actually classmates of mine at Stanford, a few years older than me, but I didn't know them on campus. We met through a mutual friend after. And what inspired me about them was their focus on the system. They were inspired by the Occupy Wall Street movement. Vlad is an immigrant and Beju is the son of immigrants. And to them, it was completely un-American that in this country, if you were rich, you could get richer. But if you were not, account minimums were too high. Fees ate up a higher portion of your net worth in your trades. You didn't have access to the same compounding assets that those who are wealthy do, and on and on and on. And they just thought that was not how it should be. And as they studied the brokerage industry, they realized that it was essentially a cartel, right? The commissions that all of these guys used to charge was a legacy of an old system when trading used to be offline, right? When trading used to be offline, there was a cost. That cost was you and me having to trade. When trading moved online, that cost went to zero. And in fact, that cost became negative. All of these brokers now get paid because they route trades through market makers. And so as I studied this industry, they were like, wait a second, why are all of these guys still charging the commission when they're actually making money on a per trade basis? And that was the opportunity for Robinhood. Robinhood realized that you could build a mission-driven company focused on the end consumer, focused on reducing price to zero, and build a better experience for all so everybody can access it. And a lot of people were like, who cares? $7.95 is nothing. But guess what? $7.95 matters a lot when you're buying $30 of stock, right? That's very different than when you're buying $1 million of stock. And so Robinhood became this phenomenon where the growth for the first many years of its company was all viral. It was not a single dollar of marketing was spent in, I think, for the first 4 or 5 years of the business, because people were just referring other people and it was an awesome product and it was mission driven and it was a cool brand. And they continue to grow really nicely. And obviously with great growth comes great responsibility and sometimes growing pains. And we've had our fair share of those, but I'm just really proud of the team for staying focused on what actually matters at the end of the day, which is, are you getting customers the best deal and the best experience?
Yeah. What qualities do you think make for, you know, a really exceptional founder and management team?
I have found that great founders look different. They come from different backgrounds. They smell different. They're different in every way, except for one common thread. And that common thread seems to be that they're very thoughtful. They're always one step ahead of me or anybody else who's asking them questions about their business. Because they've thought about it, they have analyzed it, and they have an answer. It may not be the right answer, but they've at least thought about it. When I get worried is when we're asking all these questions and there's one question they haven't thought of. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wait a second, we've thought about your business for an hour. You've thought about your business for a year. How come there's a question you haven't thought of? And that's the main thing we look for, thoughtfulness. We have a company called Two Chairs, which is in the mental health space. And Two Chairs essentially has the mission of democratizing access to high quality and affordable mental health. And there was a question around regional density that I brought up with the CEO. Essentially, I asked, when we were investing, I think it was one clinic in the Bay Area. And a lot of us investors were like, oh, you should expand all over the country right away. Oh, California, New York, this, that. And he was like, look, there is a real advantage in regional density. The advantage comes from three main elements. One is customer acquisition. Two is therapist acquisition. And three is payer relationships. You're more likely to get a state-based payer working with your system if you have regional density in that system. And to me, that was a really thoughtful answer. I had thought of one and two. I can understand why it's useful for customers and therapists, but I hadn't thought of the payer piece.
Right.
And he was thinking about this when he had one clinic. That's a level of thoughtfulness that we gauge.
I know you wouldn't talk about this, but I have to ask because you're a very young person. Your brother is a very young person. You guys have accomplished so much. I know your brother because we invested in his business as well, and he's exited a couple of companies and also worked in investing in companies. What did your parents feed you? What did they do to grow such smart, accomplished kids?
That's very kind of you. We attribute a lot of our, probably all of our success to actually our upbringing. And one of our board partners is a guy named Alec Ross, who I think you may know. And Alec actually wrote a book called Industries of the Future. Every chapter is about a new industry that will emerge in the next few years. But the last chapter is about parenting. And he actually profiles my parents in that chapter. And I like to say they have immortalized themselves. But essentially what they did is we moved around a lot as a kid. I was born in California, but we moved around all over. And they came from very little. My dad applied to schools that didn't have an application fee because that's what he could afford. My mom stayed at a homeless shelter her first night in America because she thought immigrants got free housing. It's like the opposite of today. And so they taught us from an early age that we had been given so much more than they ever had. And they showed that to us. We were not wealthy growing up, but whenever my parents saved money, they would take us somewhere. And they would take us somewhere far away. So for example, in 1998, we went to Kenya and we visited orphanages. We really just saw other people of our age, but who were in very different circumstances. And they repeated that many times over in different markets, in different geographies. And ultimately, they gave us two realizations. One is it made us realize how privileged we were and that we should do something with our privilege. And two, it made us actually comfortable operating in a lot of these places, because we realized these people were not that, they were not different from us. We were far more similar than we are different. And so I think that's why when you look at the type of investing or company building that both my brother and I do, it's very global. Like my brother's, as you know, his company was based in frontier markets. I attribute his comfort operating in frontier markets largely due to the trips my parents made with us when we were children, and similar to the type of investing that I do now.
And what made you personally very interested in venture capital specifically?
I believe venture capital can be a tremendous source of social change. I think entrepreneurship is an amazing source of social change. When I was in college, I read the stories of entrepreneurs all around the world. And I realized that capitalism, when done correctly, can solve a lot of problems. It doesn't solve every problem. And there are a lot of problems that can't be solved through capitalism. Look at criminal justice in this country, or affordable housing, or gun violence. But there are a number of problems that can be solved through a big idea and some really hardworking people behind that big idea. And I realized entrepreneurship is really driven by two sets of people. One are the founders and then their employees. And then the second set of people are their believers, right? And the believers are the families who support them, the investors who back them, the advisors who guide them, and that whole ecosystem around it. So that I just wanted to be a part of the ecosystem.
Right. Do you ever see yourself being on the opposite end of the coin and starting your own company at some point?
I don't necessarily think I will go back and start another company. I feel like one thing I've learned is how difficult it is to start a business and how anomalous it is when something actually works, because everything is moving against you, right? Big companies often don't want you to exist. Sometimes the government doesn't want you to exist. Employees often don't want to work for you because you can't pay them enough. And so if you actually survive, you are the few. And so I think I'd rather do something in public service or civil rights or something like that.
What advice do you have for founders, just in terms of starting a business, what it takes to run their company, what it takes to succeed?
Founding a business is probably the hardest thing there is. And the only way, at least the only way I have seen people persevere through all the lows, is by having that North Star of why you're doing it. And so if you don't have that North Star, in my opinion, it's not the right way to do it. The right way to do it is to really believe in a certain problem or mission. And if you do find that, run at it. Start that business because the world needs it. I guess that would be my advice. Just really focus on why you're doing this.
I think that's great advice.
Because there are a lot better ways to make money. There are a lot better ways to spend your time, you know? So just really focus on the right thing.
Yeah, you have to be really passionate about it. So with that, we're going to jump into our four standard question segment. And the goal here is that we ask four standard questions to all of our guests just to get to know them better and obviously on a more personal level. So the first question is, if you could have a magic wand and change or improve something about the VC industry, what would it be and why?
I think one thing I would love is if people focused less on backgrounds of individuals, like where they went to school and what they look like. Because my belief is that has nothing to do with your entrepreneurial ability. Just because two kids dropped out of Stanford and founded Google does not mean, therefore, every two kids from Stanford are going to found the next Google. It also doesn't mean that somebody who didn't go to college and is from Nigeria or India or somewhere else is not going to found the next Google. I just wish there was less pattern bias, if you will. At the end of the day, where you went to college simply is an indicator of how well you were doing on test scores and grades between the ages of 13 and 17. So that should not be the indicator of whether you get venture capital funding later in life.
And if you made it a priority too, right? A lot of people didn't. It doesn't mean that they're not intelligent or capable or so. I totally agree. And so secondly, if you weren't a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
I think I'd be like a civil rights litigator. I think you can go after similar issues with a similar mindset, I should say, where high risk, high reward. You can find a really big issue and try and find the right plaintiff and the right cause of action and under the right sort of set of facts and law and try and change the system. That's essentially what David Boies and Ted Olson did with Obergefell, which legalized gay marriage. It's what they did back in the day with Brown v. Board, which desegregated the schools. And so I think you can have tremendous impact if you really focus on the right problem.
So in a similar vein then, who is someone that you look up to and why?
There are a lot of people I look up to. I think, man, this is a tough question because there are personal, right? I look up to my parents and my grandparents because of all that they went through. My great-grandfather was a freedom fighter in India and spent time in jail fighting against the British. And it was part of the whole nonviolent protest. And I look up to him. I think what he did was amazing. One of our board partners is Julia Gillard. She was the first and only so far female prime minister of Australia. She endured a lot going through what she did when she was in office. And she came out of that unscathed and still very optimistic about the world and always sees a positive in people. And I tend to gravitate towards the personal qualities in people as opposed to the professional qualities when I answer that question or think about that question in terms of who I admire.
And then the fourth question is, what is the best piece of advice that you have ever received?
There's a quote, and it's my favorite quote. And it actually, the only reason I know about the quote is it came to me in the form of advice, which is, it goes as follows. If you ever think you are too small to make an impact, you have never been in bed with a mosquito.
That's a funny one, but it's a good one.
Yeah. And so I love that quote. All of us have immense power, and it's really up to us to use it.
Love that.
Sheel, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it and appreciate your insights.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for doing this, guys.
And follow us on Twitter at ProofVC or on our website at proof.vc.